dimensions by way of a tesseract, a cube that extends into the fourth dimension, time, which would have to be rendered visually. In both cost and scope, it promised to be a much larger film than anything DuVernay had done before. Also challenging was the very idea of a big-budget Hollywood movie whose protagonist was a cerebral 13-year-old girl wearing glasses. There was a time when DuVernay could not have imagined such a meeting. She was raised in the city of Compton in Los Angeles County. Compton has a reputation for being a rough neighborhood, but for DuVernay, it was a beautiful place where she was surrounded by family and friends. The oldest of five, DuVernay grew up watching her mother go to school at night, then move up from a job as a bank teller to a position in hospital administration to a role as the head of an HR department. Her aunt introduced her to films, taking her to the movies and talking with her about what they'd seen, and about the cinema more generally. As a child, she'd aspired to become a lawyer. In eighth grade, her grandmother Charlene bought her a briefcase, and she felt a few steps closer to her dream. DuVernay attended an all-girls Catholic school for 12 years, where she became the first black homecoming queen and student body president. After graduating from UCLA, where she studied African American history, DuVernay worked in journalism before starting her own film publicity company and spending 14 years as a Hollywood marketer and publicist. As someone who'd always been interested in movies, she relished having a role in the industry. She found herself on many sets and having long conversations with directors during plane rides to press junkets and premieres. She told Interview Magazine in 2012, "As a publicist, I was always around filmmakers. I started thinking they're just regular people like me with ideas. I've got ideas." Even so, acting on these ideas would mean a delayed start in a field already overcrowded with extraordinary talent. At first, DuVernay hesitated. She said in an interview, "But I started to realize that being so close to great filmmakers and watching them direct on set, and the experiences that I did have, although different from film school, were still super valuable. I coupled that with some very intentional study and practice, picking up a camera, and just started making it." She was 32 when she directed her first short film. On the path to Hollywood success, DuVernay faced several challenges as a woman in a male-dominated industry. Having men invade her personal space and question her leadership made her think carefully about her appearance on the set, including how she dressed. She often wore a hat to avoid unwanted hair touchers, people interested in touching her locks, and glasses so that nobody would mistakenly get the impression that her eyes were welling up during a particularly moving scene, when in fact she was simply having trouble with her contact lenses. "You don't want to get caught up with the glistening," she told an audience at the LA Film Independent Forum. "Especially as a lady director, that's when the grip is going to walk by and say, 'She was crying.' It's just not worth it." Her lack of industry connections, or as she put it, a rich uncle, increased the odds against DuVernay, and it sometimes stung to imagine where she might have gotten with some well-placed help. But then one day it hit her. She says, "All of the time you're spending trying to get someone to mentor you, trying to have a coffee, all of the things we try to do to move ahead in the industry, is time that you're not spending working on your screenplay, strengthening your character arcs, setting up a table reading to hear the words, thinking about your rehearsal techniques, thinking about your symbolism in your production design, your color palette. All of the so-called action that you're doing is hinging on someone doing something for you." Her first two features were small-budget films, including one she financed with her own savings. Then came Selma, the story of the 1965 voting rights campaign that Martin Luther King Jr. led. The film was bold and bracingly self-assured, according to A.O. Scott of the New York Times. He wrote, "Even if you think you know what's coming, Selma hums with suspense and surprise. Packed with incident and overflowing with fascinating characters, it is a triumph of efficient, emphatic cinematic storytelling." Washington Post critic Anne Hornaday described DuVernay's film as A stirring, often thrilling, uncannily timely drama that works on several levels at once, Selma carries viewers along on a tide of breathtaking events so assuredly that they never drown in the details or the despair, but instead are left buoyed. The civil rights movement and its heroes aren't artifacts from the distant past, but messengers sent on an urgent mission for today. In addition to the Oscar recognition, Selma was the first film helmed by an African-American woman to be nominated for Best Picture. DuVernay earned a Golden Globe nomination for Best Director. After Selma, DuVernay showed no signs of slowing down. Queen Sugar, a series she created for the Oprah Winfrey Network, became a critical success, praised for its clever storytelling, strong sense of place, and thoughtful depictions of characters rarely glimpsed in pop culture, African-American farmers in the rural South. DuVernay decided to recruit only female directors for the series, thinking it would be quite a radical statement. Instead of using typical Hollywood channels for hiring, she sought filmmakers whose work had inspired her over the years, in some cases connecting with them via Twitter. She also scouted independent films. DuVernay was responding in part to challenges she herself had faced, some subtle. In interviews, journalists asked her about her background as an African American, about being a woman in the film industry, about everything but making films. She was black, a black woman, a black director, but rarely just a director, seldom asked strictly about her vision for a film or how she approached rehearsals. These were questions for white male directors. And so DuVernay fought back. Along with seeking out unsung talent, she hosts a podcast, The Call-In, in which she invites African-American filmmakers to discuss their writing, shooting, and editing in detail. Her questions skip over race and identity, and instead she asks her guests to zero in on the technical and creative process behind the work. Arriving at Disney, DuVernay was able to put all these issues and frustrations out of her mind. She knew Bailey and Negenda, who had already made clear how much they admired her work. DuVernay said in an interview with Vice, "In that particular room, for the first time, I was able to walk in and tell my story." She walked into the office, she said, like a white man does. It did not take long for the Disney pair to realize that DuVernay was the right person to adapt A Wrinkle in Time. In follow-up discussions, DuVernay suggested that Meg could come from a mixed-race family, and that the film, in part, would be about how Meg became more comfortable in her own skin. Bailey and Negenda thought the idea was brilliant, and the job was hers. A different studio might have pitched DuVernay another Selma-like project, but Bailey and Negenda had a broader conception of her potential. They saw her for her talent, not her race, and DuVernay responded. When she sat down to talk with the Disney producers that February evening, she was just a filmmaker, ready to trade ideas about the work she was passionate about. All of the other stuff and baggage, she said, was not there. At 9 o'clock on a spring morning in Cambridge, Massachusetts, I was in my office, anxiously checking my phone. Given where I was headed, I was cheered, at least, by the blue sky after days of heavy rain. I wasn't teaching, so I had dressed in business casual, blue cropped pants, a short-sleeved gray sweater, and flats. A colleague from Harvard Business School had offered to pick me up and take me to the Registry of Motor Vehicles, where I had finally scheduled a driving test, after years of living in the United States without a license. I had passed a driver's test in Italy many years ago, but I was still a bundle of nerves. Failing in front of my colleague would be humiliating. Plus, he was lending me his car for the test, a BMW 6 Series. A little scratch could translate into a large bill. My colleague's text pinged on my phone, and I zipped up my backpack and headed to our meeting point, where I found him dressed in a gray pinstriped suit. He said, smiling, "The outfit is not to celebrate your American driving license. I'll be teaching later today." Soon we were in the parking lot of a Watertown mall, awaiting my turn behind the wheel. My friend listed common mistakes to avoid during the test, from rolling stops and improper lane changing to driving too slowly. He was interrupted by a tall DMV officer in dark sunglasses who called my last name. The officer told me as we approached the BMW, "You can get into the driver's seat now, and your dad can sit in the back and come with us, but he'll have to stay quiet." I tried to stifle a laugh while my colleague, who was only about 15 years older than me, climbed in behind us. I was sure the officer didn't mean any offense. He just made a quick judgment based on our appearance, my colleague's suit, my backpack. After all, he must have been quite accustomed to dads riding along on driving tests. Stereotypes, sets of attributes we associate with particular groups, are rooted in the fundamental mechanics of human thought. We make links and abide by them, thunder and rain, gray hair and old age, daughter and father showing up together for a driving test. In a world where the fittest survive, animals have evolved to make snap judgments about predators. Some chimpanzees instinctively attack chimps outside of their group. Certain fish go after their own kind simply because they weren't hatched in the same lake. We humans also distrust outsiders. To distinguish friend from foe, we have evolved to judge people using easily observed criteria, such as age, weight, skin color, and gender, as well as educational level, disability, accent, sexuality, social status, and job. Stereotypes can help us make sense of the world, but because they are mere generalizations, they can also stir up a great deal of trouble. Irritating behavior, like the officer calling my colleague "your dad," is the least of the threat. When we buy into stereotypes, we can sometimes end up perpetrators of cruelty and discrimination, often without even being aware of it. Rebels, by contrast, realize that stereotypes are blinding, and that fighting the tendency to stereotype produces a clearer picture of reality and a competitive advantage. Rebels do not thoughtlessly accept the social roles and attitudes that society promotes. They challenge such roles and attitudes, never missing an opportunity to prove them wrong. When we're not careful, stereotypes act like firewalls, blocking new information from penetrating our thoughts and preventing us from changing our minds unless something truly dramatic happens. In the 1999 film Beautiful People, which is set in London during the Bosnian War, there is a scene in which a young doctor brings home a Balkan War refugee who has recently arrived in the city, someone whom she and the viewer knows nothing about. At the dinner table, the doctor's conservative upper-class family comes across as a group of patronizing snobs, while the refugee appears to be unsophisticated and uneducated. And then the refugee sits down at the family's piano and starts to play Souvenir d'Andalousie for piano, a romantic piece by American composer Louis Gottschalk. He plays masterfully, and in the process catapults both the family and the viewer out of stereotypical assumptions, so that we can view him, and maybe others like him, through a new lens. Whenever I talk about stereotypes in the classroom, I give my students a little test. On a big screen, I flash words like desk, kitchen, and computer, one after another, and I ask them to shout out whether each word belongs to a category shown at the top left of the screen, such as career, or a category on the top right, such as home. My students always perform well when matching work-related words such as desk and computer to career, and home-related words such as kitchen and children to home. They also have no trouble matching typical male names like Brian to the category male, and typical female names like Katie to the category female. To make the task more difficult, I then have a round where the words flashing on the screen include both first names and words related to either career or home. The students need to shout out left or right to indicate whether the word that appeared on the screen belongs to one of the two categories, male or career, on the top left, or to one of the two categories, female or home, on the top right of the screen. When this is what the task calls for, they rarely falter. The trouble comes when I ask them to switch these orientations, having female names and career as the two categories listed on one side of the screen, and male names and home as the two categories listed on the other. Now, all of a sudden, they stumble, performing half as fast. Right then, their bias sinks in. Men belong with work and the business world, and women at home. It hardly matters that the students, as they are quick to remind me, do not hold overt biases against working women. In fact, many of them are working women. We associate men with work more quickly because we are more used to seeing men in the workforce. This kind of thinking surfaces early in life. By 10 months, when shown faces of men and women, infants begin to make stereotypical associations with gender-typed objects, such as a hammer or a scarf, telling us that even babies can perform primitive stereotypes. By about age 3, children exhibit a capacity to understand sex differences that have to do with adult possessions, shirt, skirt, tie, toys, roles, physical appearance, and activities. Children at about the same age also identify abstract associations related to gender, for example, softness as female, hardness as male. When researchers examine the spontaneous associations children make regarding girls and boys, they find a consistent pattern in which children from preschool through fifth grade view girls as soft and nice, wearing skirts or dresses, and playing with dolls, and boys as being rough, having short hair, and enjoying active games. Parents set the scene for gender stereotypes even before their children are born, decorating boys' rooms with airplanes and trucks, for instance, and girls' rooms with princesses and stuffed animals, and the fairy tales children hear at bedtime or watch on TV and in movies can affect how they see themselves and others. These stories often portray weak female characters who succeed only when a man intervenes. Think of Prince Eric providing Ariel with a life of luxury on land in The Little Mermaid, or Prince Charming helping Cinderella out of rags and into riches. Although Disney has lately strived to reduce stereotypical storylines in its films, as in Frozen, Moana, and A Wrinkle in Time, which feature strong female characters, most entertainment continues to conform to old ideas about gender. Once learned, stereotypes and prejudices are hard to shed, even when evidence contradicts them. They are reinforced over time by the comfortable feelings we experience when interacting with others like us, people of the same gender, race, ethnicity, or political leaning. When we feel similar to others, we tend to think of them the same way we think about ourselves, and we also tend to assume we'll get along. Through adolescence and into adulthood, we continue to gravitate to people just like us. Conversation and cooperation feel easier when preferences, habits, and views are basically the same. Meanwhile, dealing with people who are dissimilar can cause friction, which feels unsettling or unproductive. Research on romantic relationships shows that, contrary to the old adage, opposites attract, we are attracted to people similar to us, and we feel more comfortable in groups in which we're surrounded by the like-minded, segregating ourselves accordingly from an early age. Those who dare to violate stereotypes often experience a backlash, researchers have found. For women perceived as successful in masculine fields, the backlash can be especially strong. In a study in which women were portrayed as competent employees in a stereotypically masculine field, such as finance or construction, research participants rated them as being just as competent as their male counterparts, but less likable. When it was left ambiguous whether women were qualified in such a field, participants perceived them as less likable and less competent than their male counterparts. As a result, participants believed the women should receive lower salary offers and fewer promotions and resources than men with the same qualifications. Former Canadian Prime Minister Kim Campbell once said, "I don't have a traditionally female way of speaking. I'm quite assertive. If I didn't speak the way I do, I wouldn't have been seen as a leader. But my way of speaking may have grated on people who were not used to hearing it from a woman. It was the right way for a leader to speak, but it wasn't the right way for a woman to speak." The initial rise of women in the workplace was due to external circumstances. In the United States, during both World War I and World War II, women were needed to fill factory jobs, replacing men who had been killed or injured in battle. During wartime, many women joined the military, working as nurses, driving trucks, repairing airplanes, or performing clerical work, so that the men were freed up for combat. Others flocked to civil service jobs, while some worked as engineers and chemists, developing weapons for the war. Though many women had to relinquish their roles to returning veterans after both wars, the wars solidified the notion that women were in the workforce to stay. As professional opportunities expanded, women weren't the only ones who benefited. There were gains for the companies they joined and for the economy more broadly. Those gains are no less a reality today. A recent report by management consulting firm McKinsey & Company used proprietary data on 366 public companies across a wide range of industries in the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, and Latin America, and found that firms belonging to the top quartile for gender diversity are 15% more likely to experience financial returns above the median of their respective national industry. The organizations where women lead show better financial performance. An increase in female participation in the labor force also accelerates economic growth. In fact, increasing the number of women in the workforce can boost a country's GDP by as much as 21%. But change did not happen without resistance. When women initially entered the workforce, venturing into factories and offices during the Industrial Revolution, men typically viewed them, along with the rise of machinery, for that matter, as a threat to their status, and many women were criticized for taking jobs from men, even if this wasn't the case. For women with husbands and children, the backlash was even stronger. Working mothers took the blame for increases in juvenile delinquency, and unlike men, women faced the double bind of juggling work outside the home and caring for their families. We now understand the psychology behind the resistance women have faced. We think of women as communal, other-oriented, modest, affectionate, helpful, gentle, pleasant, sensitive, and nice, while men are considered agentic, or independent, strong, forceful, self-focused, competent, and competitive. As a result, we expect men to pursue their career goals while women stay at home as caretakers. These expectations shape the way we view men and women in the workplace. An authoritative male worker is the boss, while an authoritative woman is bossy. An assertive man is persuasive, an assertive woman pushy, and so on. Entrenched gender views lead to bias in hiring, performance reviews, and promotion decisions. In one field study, two female and two male college students were recruited to apply in person to work at 65 restaurants in Philadelphia, categorized as low, medium, or high-priced. The students' resumes made clear their similar personal histories and experience. The job they applied for was also the same, being a waiter or waitress. Most of the job offers made by high-priced restaurants went to men, 11 out of 13, and most of the offers made by low-priced restaurants went to women, 8 out of 10. Earnings would be substantially higher at the high-priced restaurants. Thus, the apparent hiring discrimination resulted in gender-based differences in earnings. But it also would harm the restaurants by depriving them of the best employees. When women are hired, it's harder for them to get ahead. A 2014 study using data from 248 performance reviews across 28 companies found that 59% of the reviews of men had critical feedback in them, as compared with 88% of the reviews of women. Both men and women received constructive feedback, but women were more likely to be criticized based on their personalities, often being told to be less loud or abrasive, to take a step back to make room for others, and to be less judgmental. In August 1982, 38-year-old Anne Hopkins was proposed as a candidate for partner at the accounting firm Price Waterhouse. Since joining the firm 4 years earlier, she had brought in an estimated $40 million in revenue, more than any other partnership candidate. She had also billed more hours in 1981 and 1982 than any of the 88 other candidates. In the nominating proposal prepared by her group, Hopkins was praised for her outstanding performance. Yet various male partners evaluated her as being too macho and in need of charm school. More than half the nominees were promoted to partner, but Hopkins, the only woman, wasn't one of them. One partner who supported her promotion told her about the feedback from the voting partners. She was, according to them, overly aggressive, unduly harsh, difficult to work with, impatient with staff, overcompensated for being a woman, and universally disliked. Another partner advised her to walk more femininely, talk more femininely, dress more femininely, wear makeup, have her hair styled, and wear jewelry. The praise she received was grudging. One partner said she had matured from a tough-talking, somewhat masculine, hard-nosed manager to an authoritative, formidable, but much more appealing lady partner candidate. It was true that Hopkins was an unconventional woman for the era. She swore like a sailor, drank beer at lunch, smoked, rode motorcycles, carried a briefcase instead of a purse, and wore little makeup or jewelry. Then again, she was allergic to makeup, and even if she weren't, she thought it'd be difficult to apply, given her inability to see much without her trifocals. She found that putting everything she needed in a briefcase was easier than having to also carry a purse, especially when she was managing a suitcase. In any case, she didn't understand what such trivial matters had to do with her job. Pricewaterhouse had given Hopkins 1 year to demonstrate the personal and leadership qualities required of a partner. But just 4 months later, she was informed that she was unlikely to be promoted. In December 1983, she received some unexpected news. She would not be re-proposed for a partnership, even if reviews of her work were, on balance, favorable. Meanwhile, the 19 men who had been placed on hold along with Hopkins fared much better. 15 of them were promoted to partner that year. For Hopkins, it was the last straw. 4 days before Christmas, she resigned. Although Hopkins had these experiences in the 80s, women continue to be underrepresented in top management positions today. In 2017, only 32 Fortune 500 firms had female CEOs, in part because both men and women believe that effective leadership requires masculine traits. Research suggests that in our minds, good managers are typically male. Women are often perceived as less competent and as having less leadership potential than men, and thus are more likely to encounter skepticism and backlash when they behave aggressively in the workplace and go for top positions. And other women are as likely to discriminate as men. When women are in charge, both men and women criticize them for being bossy, cold, bitchy, or aggressive, all attributes at odds with traditionally feminine features such as compassion, warmth, and submissiveness. More often, women are found toiling behind the scenes. When teaching at the MBA level, I often ask students to complete group projects in teams of 4 or 5. Though not a favorite among students, these projects are an effective way to teach both the class materials and teamwork. Still, I usually find myself spending many hours dealing with the same issue. One student ends up doing most or all of the work, while everyone on the team earns the same score. And often I find it's a female student who ends up picking up the slack for the rest of the team. Research suggests that this pattern is common in groups. Women carry at least as much of the load, if not more, than men, but the men get more credit. When male employees bring ideas forward, their performance evaluations are higher. When women propose the same ideas, managers' perceptions of their performance do not change. Similarly, when executives speak up rather than staying silent, they receive competence ratings that are 10% higher when they are male. But when the executives engaging in the exact same behavior are female, their ratings suffer. They are 14% lower. This is bad not just for the women who carry the weight of their groups, but also for their organizations. Think of how much potential is yet to be tapped. If some members are slacking off just because they know someone else will step up to the plate, the team won't live up to its potential, and the organization won't either. It is hard to overstate how much there is to gain when everyone contributes. In July 2010, less than a month after being promoted to associate professor at Harvard Business School, I had to teach my first executive education class, part of a one-week program designed for leaders from all sorts of businesses across the globe. I was initially a bit nervous about telling a group of almost 90 experienced executives how to be effective negotiators, but by the end of the week, I felt good about how things had gone. Later, the chair of the executive education program came by to tell me that he was about to send out the student feedback from the course. There was, he warned, one comment that would probably upset me. He was giving me a heads up in the hope that I would read it and then move on, without dwelling on it. About an hour later, the email came. The ratings were good overall, but as my colleague had warned, one comment stood out. Professor Gino should wear less well-fitted clothes. This would allow the students in her classes to pay more attention to what she is saying, rather than being distracted by her clothes. Had I worn a slinky low-cut dress? No, I had worn a dark, conservative pantsuit. Yes, it was cut for a woman, but it was not tight or revealing. A few years later, I taught another executive class. This time, I had more experience under my belt, and I also had a larger belly. I was 8 months pregnant. Before the start of the session, a male executive approached me to say that pregnant women are known for tiring easily, and that I probably should have asked somebody else to teach my class. I didn't know how to respond. "Good luck, though," he said, breaking the awkward silence. "We'll see how it goes." Once the class began, I looked around at the executives, most of whom were men. I couldn't help but imagine that they were wondering why they did not have a more experienced, thinner professor leading the class, someone not at risk of passing out from exhaustion or suddenly going into labor. They were leaning back in their chairs, as if signaling that they were not interested in what I had to tell them, as if they doubted my teaching skills. Were my perceptions correct, or had the student's comment rattled me? Moments like this have stuck with me over the years. Sometimes they come to mind when I'm preparing for an executive education class or a consulting meeting, or running a training session in the field. They make me wonder what expectations my audience might have based on my female first name, and then, after I enter the room, what additional assumptions they make. Women in my classes often relay feedback they have received in their own organizations, comments that they doubt male colleagues get, observations about their dress, criticisms of their assertiveness, and other remarks that have nothing to do with their actual work. The effect of such judgments is truly insidious. Imagine, for example, that you are a woman, likely easier for some of you than others. You walk into a meeting and see that all the other participants are male. Before anyone speaks, you feel less confident than the men about how you will come across, so you find yourself hesitating before speaking. That's when one of the men jumps in and proposes an agenda. You try to argue a certain point, but your voice betrays your nervousness. Detecting your insecurity, the men dismiss your concerns. Their dismissal leaves you shaken, and you fall silent. Too bad, because the subject under discussion is one you know well. When you speak up again, you have trouble holding the floor to present your view. The final decision suffers the absence of your expertise. This is common. Especially when outnumbered, women are frequently interrupted, talked over, shut down, and penalized for speaking out. Men, research consistently shows, dominate both conversations and decision-making processes in corporate offices, school boards, town meetings, and government. In fact, the more power men have, the more they talk, which is not the case for women. Similarly, men who show anger at work are rewarded with more respect and authority, but angry women are seen as incompetent and unworthy and are penalized. These experiences, in turn, affect confidence, expectations, and future behavior. For instance, the sexist comments I received in my executive classes made me nervous about teaching or even interacting with executives in the future. Psychologist Claude Steele refers to this phenomenon as stereotype threat, or the tendency to choke and underperform due to the fear of bias. Consider the stereotype that female students are naturally inferior in math and science. In a study in which women were reminded of their gender before taking a math test, they scored lower than equally qualified men who took the same test. The women's performance suffered because they were worried about confirming negative stereotypes, the researchers found. However, when reassured of equal ability before the test, the women matched the performances of men. Similar results have been found for African American and Latino students. Stereotypes predict they will underperform in academic pursuits relative to whites, and they do underperform when primed to think about race. Reminders can also be visual. Studies have shown that women score higher in math when surrounded by other women than when testing in a mixed-gender group. The consequences of stereotype threat go well beyond poor performance on tests. We can also find ourselves closed off from others, less ambitious, and disengaged from our work, unable to fulfill our potential as leaders, negotiators, entrepreneurs, and competitors. Of course, the consequences hurt not only those who experience the threat, but also their organizations. And a vicious cycle develops. When women experience stereotype threat, their mental energy is taxed as they work to disprove the stereotype, leaving them with less mental energy to perform the task at hand. This creates more stress and lower performance, thus maintaining the underrepresentation of women in the workplace, especially in leadership positions. All of us are part of some group that can be affected by negative perceptions, and we know we may be judged by it. No one is immune to stereotype threat. But here's the good news. Expectations can influence results. This insight has been demonstrated for years through the use of medical placebos. In one study, patients received intravenous injections of morphine over the course of 2 days to reduce the pain created by dental work. On the third day, the same patients received an injection of saline that they thought was a powerful painkiller. Patients who received the placebo tolerated the pain much better than what one would normally expect, even from people given morphine. Outside of medicine, the same phenomenon holds. The simple fact of knowing that I'll soon be in a meeting with a potential client, working on a joint project with new colleagues, or in a class full of executives, leads to expectations of how well I think I'll do. The interaction proceeds accordingly. If I expect to do well, I'll feel more comfortable and excited. As a result, I'll not only perform better, but I will also be judged, research shows, as more competent and even wittier. In a similar way, we can shape our expectations about the behavior of others. For instance, when looking over the roster for my executive class, I might tell myself that I expect my students to make particularly clever comments and to do well in even the most challenging exercises. Once my expectations are set, research shows, I'll behave differently toward my students in a way that confirms my positive expectations. A story from Greek mythology has inspired much research on the topic of how expectations influence behavior, Pygmalion. According to the story, told most vividly in the ancient Roman poet Ovid's Metamorphoses, Pygmalion was a talented sculptor from Cyprus who had become disgusted by some local prostitutes and as a result had lost all interest in women. Dedicating himself to his work, he spent long hours crafting a beautiful statue of a woman, Galatea, out of ivory. When he finally put his chisel down, he was captivated by the woman he had created. She was so perfect that Pygmalion, despite his professed disdain of all women, fell deeply in love. He began to bring the statue gifts such as beads, seashells, songbirds, and flowers. Pygmalion prayed to the goddess Aphrodite to bring Galatea to life, and she granted his wish. In a sense, though, his expectations were what had brought her to life. The story of Pygmalion has resonated across the centuries. In George Bernard Shaw's 1912 play, Pygmalion, which was later turned into a 1956 Broadway musical and then into the popular film My Fair Lady, Professor Henry Higgins works hard to transform an uncouth Cockney flower girl named Eliza Doolittle into a refined young lady, becoming besotted with her in the process. Psychologists have studied what they call the Pygmalion effect, in which a person's expectations of another person turn into a self-fulfilling prophecy. Evidence of the effect emerged in 1965 when students in a California school completed a test that was described to them as one that would identify growth spurters, students who were poised to make strides in their academic journey. Teachers were given the names of elementary school children who allegedly had great intellectual potential. Although these children were chosen at random, they showed a larger gain in performance than their peers when they were tested again at the end of the year. The only significant difference between them and their classmates was in the minds of the teachers. These days, I find that I often benefit from the Pygmalion effect in my own teaching. When my colleagues, usually male and older than me, introduce me to my executive education classes now, they stress that I have won various teaching awards, or that I became a full professor at an unusually young age. These accolades, presented by a clear authority figure, seem to improve any low stereotype-based expectations the students may bring to the class. We can also choose to rebel against low expectations that others set for us. Research has found that approaching high-stakes performance situations by telling ourselves that we're excited rather than telling ourselves to simply calm down lowers our anxiety and improves our performance. If we fear a backlash, we can frame the upcoming task as an opportunity to learn and improve rather than dwelling on our anxiety. Rebels know to expect the most out of everyone, including themselves. I made the conscious choice to harness this rebel spirit rather than succumbing to stereotype threat in the fall of 2010 when I was asked to teach in the same executive education program in which I had previously received the comment about my supposedly too tight clothes. I agreed, but after seeing the list of who else would be on the teaching team, all incredibly accomplished men with many years of teaching and consulting experience, I felt nervous. I was the only woman, I had a weird accent, and I was clearly younger than the other instructors, not to mention the executives I would be teaching. But as I walked to campus for the first class in the program, I decided to focus on the fact that it would be a great learning opportunity for me. I told myself to be excited to be part of such an accomplished teaching team, rather than stressed. Ultimately, the program went well, and I eventually became a regular member of the team. When we fight stereotype threats and reframe situations by focusing on opportunities rather than potential problems, we make personal gains by embracing challenging situations that we would otherwise shy away from. But fighting a stereotype threat also has an added benefit. Our behavior, once we are part of the action, can motivate others to follow our lead. Our examples and stories can change how others think, often in powerful ways. In February 1966, 23-year-old Roberta Bobby Gibb reached into her mailbox in San Diego and eagerly tore open the letter she found from the Boston Athletic Association. She was expecting to see her race number for the upcoming Boston Marathon. Instead, she found that her request to compete had been denied because women were not allowed to race. Women, the letter said, were not psychologically able to run the race. Gibb was a lifelong runner who had been training for Boston for 2 years. On the day of the marathon, she showed up at the starting line, the hood of her sweatshirt pulled over her head to disguise her gender. When her fellow runners figured out that she was a woman, they encouraged her, and she lifted the hood. The press got wind of the news, and soon spectators were seeking her out and cheering her on. Gibb finished ahead of 2/3 of the men in the race and found the governor of Massachusetts waiting to congratulate her at the finish line. In 1972, partly inspired by Gibb, Boston Marathon officials opened the race to women. Examples are powerful. The daughters of working mothers grow up to benefit from their mothers' choices in their own careers, despite the old attitude that women who stay home to take care of their children are better, more devoted mothers than those who work. Women raised by working mothers are more likely to hold managerial roles than women whose mothers stay home full-time, research shows. They also earn more money. In the United States, for example, the earnings of daughters of working mothers were 23% higher than those of daughters of stay-at-home moms. As for sons of working mothers, their mother's choice of work had no effect on their employment. But as adults, they were more likely than sons of stay-at-home mothers to share in the chores and child care. At Harvard Business School, the issue of having a diverse set of role models was discussed a few years ago in relationship to our curriculum, which is heavily based on case studies. In 2014, women comprised about 20% of case study protagonists. A case study, in a way, conveys to students who should be in leadership roles. With this realization, the HBS Dean of the Faculty, Nitin Noria, encouraged the faculty to seek out more cases with females and minorities as main characters. People who are brave enough to call out discrimination, despite the fear of how it may affect their career, can have an especially potent effect. In an October 2017 New Yorker article, journalist Ronan Farrow reported allegations that Hollywood movie mogul Harvey Weinstein had sexually assaulted multiple women. In the weeks that followed, new accusations of sexual harassment and abuse against other powerful, high-profile men surfaced. When actress Alyssa Milano urged women to share their stories using the Me Too Twitter hashtag, thousands of women did so. At its peak, the hashtag was used 500,000 times in tweets in just a day. At first, the tweets were coming from women in Hollywood, but they were soon joined by women in the media, then in the art world, in comedy, in politics, in all walks of life. When a few women had the courage to speak up, others were no longer afraid. We all have opportunities, big and small, to change attitudes. When I was visibly pregnant with my second daughter, Emma, I could sometimes be seen on campus doing jumping jacks. People who walked by smiled. Others asked me what I was doing. "I am breaking common stereotypes," I told them. In 2009, Eileen Taylor, Deutsche Bank's managing director and global head of diversity, found herself staring at some puzzling internal data. Female managing directors were leaving the firm. The post involves stress and long hours, so it seemed possible that these women were leaving due to work-life balance issues. But when Taylor dug deeper, she found that this was not the case. They were leaving because they were taking better positions elsewhere and after being passed up for promotions. If Deutsche Bank was neglecting the needs of promising employees and losing them as a result, that was clearly a problem that could not be ignored, Taylor realized. Companies that can maintain and expand leadership roles for women, as Taylor wanted Deutsche Bank to do, reap large benefits. Using data from 1992 through 2006, Christian Desja of the University of Maryland and David Ross of Columbia University looked at the size and gender composition of executive management teams of most of the companies in Standard & Poor's Composite 1500 list, a group that reflects the U.S. equity market. The researchers found that, on average, female leadership generated an additional $42 million in firm value, all else being equal. The study also found that firms with a particular focus on innovation experienced larger gains when women had positions in the executive ranks. In a study of 2,360 companies using data from 2005 to 2011, researchers at the Credit Suisse Research Institute found that businesses with at least one woman on their board had lower net debt to equity, higher average returns on equity, and better average growth. Gender diversity isn't just a laudable goal. It also makes bottom-line business sense. But the benefits of more women in the workforce go beyond financial performance, surfacing in every level of an organization, including in the quality of ideas and decision-making. My own research shows that gender diversity helps companies attract and retain more talent by providing a more stimulating workplace. When a potential candidate learns that a company has a gender-diverse workforce, he or she puts more effort into getting the job. Eileen Taylor took action, spearheading an internal sponsorship program called Accomplish Top Leaders Advancement Strategy, or ATLAS, that paired women leaders at Deutsche with women mentors from the bank's executive committee. Research on the careers of both whites and minorities shows a common thread among people of color who advance the furthest, a strong network of sponsors and mentors inside their organization. Developmental relationships are important for everyone climbing the organizational ladder, but especially so for women and minorities. When DuVernay needed to hire directors for Oprah Winfrey Network's Queen Sugar, she sought to hire only female directors. She said in an interview for Hollywood Reporter, "I always say if Game of Thrones can have 3 seasons of all male directors, why can't we have 3 seasons of all women directors?" All the directors chosen for the first season of the show had directed one film that had been in competition at a film festival, but had not been able to find a job that would allow them to direct an episode of television. And after Queen Sugar, all of them ended up getting booked for other pilots or TV shows. Taylor's initiative at Deutsche Bank raised the visibility of women leaders and connected them with powerful advocates. A third of program participants won larger roles with the firm. Another third were deemed ready to move up when positions became available. Since Atlas launched in 2009, the number of women managing directors at Deutsche Bank has grown by 50%. The effort was worth it. Research shows the benefits of diversity in organizations, nations, communities, and groups. A 2009 analysis of data from 506 firms found that those with greater gender or racial diversity had higher sales revenue, a greater number of customers, and higher profits. Another study of management teams found that those who had more diverse work and educational backgrounds came up with products that were more innovative. And analyses of international data show that nations thrive by many measures, from business to medicine to art, after opening their borders to travel and immigration. People who live in more diverse geographical areas and interact with people in other regions also reap benefits from diversity. Telephone calling patterns reveal that interaction with different geographic regions, or social network diversity, is associated with greater economic prosperity in a community. Similarly, correlational evidence indicates that U.S. cities with a greater share of foreign-born inhabitants are more financially solid. And in competitive trading markets, ethnic diversity encourages more care, less bias, and greater accuracy in judgments, which in turn prevents price bubbles. For the most part, this data is correlational, showing that more diversity is related to better outcomes, but it does not allow one to conclude that greater diversity is the cause of those better outcomes. Laboratory experiments, though, have shown the causal effect that diversity has on performance. Given the constraints of the lab, these studies focus on smaller groups. But it's clear that homogeneous groups are more vulnerable to narrow-mindedness and groupthink. Diversity, by contrast, has been found to produce more innovation and better decisions in both cooperative and competitive contexts, and to strengthen teamwork. Despite the compelling evidence behind it, diversity often fails to take hold for the simple reason that homogeneous teams can feel more effective. We all tend to seek out comfort and familiarity, and this often translates into choosing to work with those who are like us. The feeling of comfort and ease in homogeneous groups was well captured in a 2008 study of fraternity and sorority members at Northwestern University in Chicago. Membership in these groups conveys a strong sense of identity, much like affiliation with a religious or political group, and can thus intensify a sense of internal similarity among members, while deepening a sense of separateness from outsiders. In this particular experiment, 132 sorority members and 68 fraternity members were asked to solve a fictional murder mystery. Each participant wore a color-coded name tag with the name of their Greek house and had 20 minutes to study the clues and pinpoint the likely suspect out of 3 possible individuals. Next, each student was assigned to a team of 3 with 2 other members of their fraternity or sorority. Each team had a total of 20 minutes to discuss the case and come up with an answer. 5 minutes into the discussions, a 4th team member joined each group. This new member was either from the same Greek house, that is, someone like them, or a different house, that is, someone who was likely different. After a team named the suspect they'd agreed on, each member answered questions about various aspects of their team's interactions. More diverse groups, those that included a person from outside their sorority or fraternity, judged the interactions within the team as less effective than did the groups of insiders. The diverse groups also showed less confidence in their final choices. This supports what we knew to be true, that members of homogeneous teams easily and readily understand one another, and collaboration on such teams flows smoothly, creating a feeling of good progress. Dealing with outsiders generates disagreements and friction, which naturally does not feel productive. Yet, the subjective experiences of the team members did not match reality. Adding an outsider actually doubled a group's chances of solving the mystery correctly, from 29% to 60%. Working in a diverse group was uncomfortable, but the outcomes were better. In fact, contrary to our intuition, greater diversity produces better outcomes exactly because it is harder to work among a mix of perspectives. Part of the reason we associate homogeneity with greater performance is our preference for information we can process easily, a bias that psychologists have named the fluency heuristic. Easy-to-digest information seems truer or more beautiful, which explains why we often appreciate songs and artwork more as they become more familiar. And when we face opinions we disagree with, discomfort is only one issue. We may also believe that disagreement will make reaching our goals more difficult and time-consuming. Again, this belief is misplaced. Think of working effectively in a group as being like studying, or exercising for that matter. No pain, no gain. Businesses can help dilute the power of stereotypes, but only if their leaders are thoughtful about it. Even seemingly benign decisions, such as which magazines are kept in a reception area, have been found to shift perceptions of an organization's stance on diversity. Whether women and minorities feel accepted depends on many workplace cues, from physical environment to offer letters. For instance, the language used in recruiting documents directly influences application rates. Masculine language in job advertisements, dominant, competitive, etc., lowers the appeal of these jobs for women. Not because women worry that they lack the skills, but because they feel they do not belong. Such cues can set off stereotype threat and shape ideas about a company's views toward a particular group. In addition to making changes to workplace cues, managers can confront stereotypes by increasing minority representation within the organization. Increasing minority representation not only increases the value placed on diversity in the eyes of potential recruits, it also aids in the development of role models, a strong predictor of success for stereotyped individuals. It's important to remember that we tend to overestimate the amount of conflict a diverse group will experience. In one study, researchers instructed MBA students to act as if they were co-managing various four-person teams of interns and to imagine that one of these teams had asked for more resources. They were shown photos of the members, four white men, four black men, or an even split. Next, they were given a transcript of a group discussion and asked to rate the team on various factors. Everyone read the same transcript, yet participants viewed teams of four white men and four black men as having the same amount of relationship conflict, and diverse teams as having more. Believing that these teams would experience greater conflict led the participants to be less likely to give additional resources to mixed-race groups. Such beliefs prompt leaders to make bad decisions when it comes to diversity, whether they are hiring, building teams, or encouraging collaboration. Fearing tension, they balk at adding diversity to a group. Rebels understand that conflict can lead to growth, and that disagreement is a feature rather than a flaw. In June 2014, the San Antonio Spurs won their fifth National Basketball Association championship in 16 seasons. The team was often described as the United Nations of Hoops. The oldest player, 38-year-old Tim Duncan, had been with the Spurs for about as long as his youngest teammate had been alive. Other players hailed from the Virgin Islands, France, Argentina, Canada, Italy, Brazil, and Australia. In fact, more than half the squad came from outside the United States, making the Spurs much more geographically diverse than the other teams in the league. They were also the first NBA team to have a female assistant coach, Becky Hammon. The Spurs' superb head coach, Greg Popovich, and top-notch players were obviously key to the team's success. But a diverse culture also played a role. Popovich, the son of a Serbian father and a Croatian mother, made it a point to learn about his players' backgrounds and to try to speak to them in their native tongues.